from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Bocelli Wallrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll get a preview of this year's Eideljord Market.
I'll find out how Beef and Boards is celebrating their 40th anniversary.
And I'll talk with writer Brian Furness about his new novel, The Lost Episodes of Reeve Bryson. And we'll have our calendar of events we call...
What'll we do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. The Eideljord Museum's Indian Market and Festival is returning June 22nd and 23rd. And Sharon Gamble invited Jack Nigg, Eideljord Festivals and Markets Manager, into our studios to learn more about the event.
You've been involved with the Indian Market and Festival for how many years now?
This will be my 12th market.
Holy moly, you've seen growth and change. What's the biggest change that's happened in that dozen years?
Oh gosh, I would have to say the biggest change is kind of there are a lot of internal things. It's a lot smoother than it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
A little less impact on the Eideljord staff. I think that one thing the visitor will see in terms of change is just the quality of art just goes up and up and up every year. I think part of that is the Eideljord's reputation grows throughout the country and artists keep coming back and then they get better and better as they hone their skills.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're really proud of the group of artists that we bring in.
Was this modeled after another museum's or another community's market, or was this something that was created fresh?
It's really interesting because Indian Market is kind of a historical thing. There's the Santa Fe Indian Market mm-hmm. in Santa Fe, and that takes over the whole plaza, the whole downtown area of their city. It's fantastic. It's a 90-year-old event.
Wow.
And that just kind of sprung up naturally through where different tribes, the Pueblos, would come and trade there. And so then you had white people and tourists, and it just sort of happened naturally. We also have a very natural trading area right on our White River where a lot of the tribes from Indiana used to come. And so it's neat that the Eideljord is situated where it is and Military Park is situated where it is. And we kind of look at it as the extension of that historical trade kind of thing. There are several Indian markets throughout the country.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a small community, very specialized, but it's also this really neat thing. There's one in Phoenix that's probably a 30 or 40 year old event, and they're affiliated with the museum, so they're very similar to ours. It was natural for the Eideljord to start doing one 22 years ago.
Sure, absolutely. How do you choose the participants or vendors, however you refer to them, the participants?
Participants, yeah, our artists, they apply. And then we have a very intensive and exciting weekend in February, in the cold, cold February. And we bring in experts in the field and we look at slides and slides and slides and slides. And they're rated on originality and craftsmanship. There's a lot of really interesting things. I've learned so much over the years. I'm not an expert in Native art at all, but I probably know more than the average bear. Just because, you know, our experts can look at a turquoise in a picture projected on the wall and know if it's stabilized or know what mine it came from or if they've worked with it. I mean, it's really neat. And then what materials they're using for pottery and paintings and a lot of the cultural items. So after that, we hone it down and we kind of get rid of those who aren't up to snuff and then we accept them.
Is part of the goal to have as wide a variety of different kinds of art as possible?
It is. I would say that it tends to be very jewelry heavy. That's just part. It's easier for jewelers to travel this far. They can put all of their wares in a tackle box and fly with it. And so, you know, the potters really have to wrap everything carefully and drive from wherever they're coming from. So we do have a lot more jewelry, but that lets us be stricter with the jewelers. They have to get higher scores to get in. And then we are able to have potters and painters and people who make traditional cultural items like kachina carvings and fetishes, really neat things. And we also have weavers and basket makers. So we try to have a wide variety of things.
I'd be remiss if I didn't ask, because I know somebody listening to this conversation has the same question I do. How do you stabilize turquoise? What is that process and why do you need to?
It has something to do with breaking it down almost into a powder and then adding some kind of a adhesive, a binder to it, and then reforming it.
Oh, wow.
Again, I'm
to
not...
To harden it.
Yeah, I'm not an expert.
Come to the market and ask one of the jewelers and find out, right?
Ask the jewelers. But it is neat. With turquoise especially, I think there's so much to learn. I mean, people just... You like what you like, but all the different colors and all the different crazy patterns that are in there in a big slab of turquoise, it's really neat.
What are some of your most of the artists aren't going to hear this conversation, so you can name your favorites. What are some of your favorite artists from the past, or favorite pieces even from the past?
Every year I say, okay, no jewelry this year, because for someone who works at a not-for-profit, I have a pretty good jewelry collection.
Yes, and because this is radio, I'll have to point out you're wearing two amazing rings, and I think your earrings might also be Native American.
Yeah, these little slabs, but my ring that I wear was my first market, so 12 years ago, the artist won Best of Show, and I bought a ring from him. To remember it by.
Sure.
I love, there's a jeweler named Mary Tafoya, who actually, she and her husband are coming to the Idoljorg in the fall as artist in residence.
Oh.
And they do this really cool mosaic, they'll do flowers or butterflies or dragonflies, just really neat stuff in turquoise and other, spiny shell, other coral, a lot of other neat stones. One of our potters, who's won Best of Show several times, she, Jody Naranjo, she does this really neat, she collects all of her own clay, she does everything.
Oh my.
She pit fires things with, you know, horse manure, like she does everything in this traditional way. She uses her grandmother's etching materials, but it's called sgraffito, how she etches onto the fired pots, and she etches these really contemporary things onto traditional pots. Love it. It's so amazing. And that would be why she's won Best of Show several times. We've got this really great artist who makes Pendleton coats, and I love the weavers, and I mean, it's so intricate, the things that they do. We've had some bead workers in the past that just do really amazing things. I tend to like traditional stuff with a contemporary twist.
Mm-hmm.
And so I like almost, we have a lot of ledger painters. So that's a...
What is that? I'm not familiar.
That's, I don't know if it's just a Native American thing, but it's pretty big in a lot of Native cultures, where they will take old papers, so land deeds or birth certificates or things like that, and then they do a painting over it. So you get these really neat antique papers that have something to do with their geography or of their tribe or whatever, and then they'll do a painting on it. And some of the paintings, we've got an artist this year, Dallin Maybe, who did this whole Where the Wild Things Are thing that I actually wanted it to be our t-shirt image, except we had some copyright issues.
Oh, shoot.
But, you know, where one of the wild things has a headdress on, mm-hmm. and they're doing sort of a native dance. So cool.
Wow.
So I like there's this traditional thing, but then this little comic kind of twist.
Modern
to it.
Twist.
It's
yeah.
neat.
Now, there are, speaking of how do the artists work, there are demonstrations available.
Absolutely. A lot of our artists work while they're sitting there. One of the funny things in working so many years with artists is that artists aren't the greatest business people. I mean, they're artists. And so a lot of times they're more comfortable if they can have that, I'm going to work on my work. And so then as a visitor approaches them, they kind of have that. They can talk about that. It helps them be more outgoing and sell, which they have to do. But that's a pretty neat thing to be able to talk to the artists like that.
Absolutely. There are also some activities. This is a family friendly
sure,
couple of
absolutely.
Days. If we brought smaller kids, what might they be seeing or doing?
One thing I think is really important is a couple years ago, we kids 17 and under are free to get in, because we know that to come to an art event, to spend, you know, $10 a person to get in and for parking, and then if you eat there, it can get pretty expensive, and we want families there. And so we've always had family activities, but I think over the last several years, we've really pumped that up. We've got a lot of hands-on stuff to do, and this year we've got things that are related to our guitar exhibit and things that are related to some of our performers and artists. We usually do a jewelry making kind of a thing. We have just games as well. And then we have a whole day of performances, both 2 days of performances. We've got a world champion, five-time world champion hoop dancer, Tony Duncan. And I'm really excited about him because he does this. He get right into my thing of mixing traditional and contemporary.
Mm-hmm.
After he won the world championship hoop dancer competition, he was approached by the Canadian recording artist Nelly Furtado.
Sure.
And so he's in one. He and his brother are hoop dance in one of her videos.
No way.
For Big Hoops, that's the name of the song.
Oh.
And in talking to him, he jumped at the chance of putting a traditional hoop dance with contemporary dance music, and he went on tour with her. So it's kind of neat. I mean, he's really good. Hoop dancing is kind of one of those things you have to see to believe. We have other rock bands who have kind of, you know, they've got drum and flute, but they're very contemporary.
Uh-huh.
Shelley Morningsong and Fabian Fontenelle, who dances. He does fancy dancing while she's performing. And then we have a group named Twin Rivers, who are actually some of our artists. They have a group. So that's pretty neat to be able to use them. And then we've got a living history village, a Delaware village. So kids, you can see history and today. So that's really neat. And then also coming to market, you get to go to the Idle George. So we've got the family area downstairs and then all of our guitar exhibit.
Yeah, you got to see the guitars or see it again.
Yeah. And then all of our other normal spaces, too. So there's a lot for the whole family to do.
Sharon Gamble with Idle George Museum Festivals and Markets Manager Jack Nigg. The museum's Indian Market and Festival is June 22nd and 23rd from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. There's also a preview party on Friday the 21st. The Indian Market is a celebration of Native American cultures through art, music, dance, demonstrations, and food. And it features Native performers and more than 150 artists from more than 60 tribes. You can learn more and see a photo of hoops dancer Tony Duncan at idlejorg.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. Beef and Board's Dinner Theater, a landmark now entering its 40th season of live entertainment, first opened on March 3, 1973. At the time, there were around 130 similar dinner theaters throughout the country, but today that number has dwindled to a sparse 7, making the Indianapolis venue a rare and enduring gem. Travis DiNicola spoke with Beef and Board's Dinner Theater owner Doug Stark about how they're celebrating their 40th anniversary.
Doug, welcome to Art of the Matter. It's great to have you here.
Well, thanks. It's great being here.
And happy anniversary to you and Beef and Boards.
Thank you. Thank you. We should sing an anniversary song of some kind, I guess.
We can work on that.
Okay.
We'll have Eddie Curry, if he joins us, sing that at the end.
Yeah,
right?
Off air. Make him off do that. Air would be much better.
So you have, now to be fair, you've not actually been there all 40 years. You've not been the owner all 40 years, though Beef and Boards has been around 40 years. But you've been there for the better part of this.
Yes, since 1980, and mm-hmm. most people think I've been there too long, but they work for me, so that's okay.
So that's okay.
They have to put up with me.
Tell me a little bit about the early history of Beef and Boards. I mean, at that time, dinner theaters were pretty popular in the U.S.
They were, when I started in dinner theater, there mm-hmm. were about 125 okay. equity. When I say equity, I mean Professional Actors Equity
sure.
Association theaters. And they were in all of the major cities. And there was a star network, people like Mickey Rooney or Cesar Romero or mm-hmm. Ann Miller mm-hmm. would travel with their own vehicle, okay. their own show, and play about 4 or 5 weeks in each. And people would come out and see these, the people that they grew up with in the
sure.
movies. And then that lasted for about 5 or 6 years, but then the newness wore off, as it does in many mm-hmm. New ventures like that. But then we took over in 1980. When I say we, Bob Zier, my former partner, and I bought the theater in 1980 and introduced the musical format.
Okay.
And at that point, we did 6 musicals and several concerts.
You guys used to do a lot of concerts. I was looking back sort of over the years.
It's pretty amazing. We had Tina Turner and Tony Bennett, the Smothers Brothers, mm-hmm. the Righteous Brothers. There were several folks that played our theater because at that time there weren't any smaller venues,
sure.
Small intimate
yeah.
kind of supper club venues.
Mm-hmm.
around, and then there weren't the huge venues that
right.
there are today.
Yeah, so that B.B. King was
there? B.B. King played for us.
That's cool.
For years. Ray Charles, Carol Channing was there for a week. We had several of the major stars come in
yeah.
On our Monday, Tuesday nights, but then the other venues started opening up.
Mm-hmm.
Marat started playing more people. The Verizon, it was Verizon. Music
Deer
Center,
Creek and all that, yeah.
Deer Creek, yeah.
I mean, you guys have really, it seems like you've reinvented yourselves on a number of occasions to continue to be viable commercial theater.
That's exactly what we try and do. We're going after the audience wherever they are. But it's reinventing ourselves without losing what we do.
Mm-hmm.
We're there specifically to entertain, and we do that about 370 performances a year.
Wow. Well, you're also there to provide work for actors, both local and regional actors and national, too. I mean, that's a really important part that I don't want to get lost in here. You mentioned equity before, the Actors Equity Union. I mean, you are a professional theater, which means these are actors who are able to work and get paid for it and you know, make a living by being a part of your theater.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that's a very important part of this. I know you've had many actors over the years who've gone through, you know, your ranks.
And the non-equity actors are paid also, and so are the children.
Mm-hmm.
7 children we have in our production of Sound of Music right now are all...
That's great.
Not only earning stage time,
mm-hmm.
which is crucial for developing young actors, but also they're getting paid for it. So it's pretty amazing.
Now, as the owner, how much of a hand do you have in the artistic elements of it?
I used to have a lot bigger hand than I have now. I'm trying to back away just
mm-hmm.
a little bit, having folks like Eddie Curry, who is now the artistic director, take over. There are several other people. Elizabeth Stark, who my daughter, has just finished directing The Sound of Music.
Mm-hmm.
And several other people like Jeff Stockberger who come in and direct one show a year. But as far as casting is concerned, that's Eddie Curry now and
mm-hmm.
myself. And before, it used to be me. I used to open almost every single show.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what about the other side of this, which we haven't really talked about yet? And that would be, if we've been talking about boards, what about the beef, the food part of this? I mean, that's a huge element of what you do. How does that work within the whole process?
Unbelievably. Dinner theater goes way back to the Greeks. Mm-hmm. I mean, when Sophocles wrote a play, it took all day, and people would bring lunch baskets.
Sure. and wine.
They'd set on wine. A lot of wine. I always say we're a lot better after you've had wine. And that part of it's been around for years. People still like to go to dinner mm-hmm. and a show.
I mean, seriously.
We just try and wrap it all together.
Those have to be two of the most difficult things to run, a theater or a restaurant. And here you are running both.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, we are.
So tell, the restaurant employs obviously a number of people as well. How does that all work?
We have about 60 people on staff mm-hmm. other than involved with the theater side of things.
Yeah.
And they have it down pretty well. We have an amazing chef, Odell Ward, who's been with me for about 27 years.
Okay.
And several other folks who kind of know which way to go and mm-hmm. what to handle and what our audience would like to have.
Well, and what you've been doing here in Indianapolis, it's great that you've been able to survive and thrive and continue. We were talking earlier about how anymore, even though there used to be a lot of dinner theaters right now, I believe you said there's about seven or so Equity.
There are seven or eight Equity dinner theaters mm-hmm. now, and about 27, 28 non-Equities that are producing on a regular level, not just, okay, well, we'll put the show on and mm-hmm. run it for three nights, and that's it.
So right now, as part of your 40th anniversary, your as you mentioned, Sound of Music is playing right now.
And that will play through that July 4th weekend. Mm-hmm. Then we open Smoke on the Mountain, which is a bluegrass gospel.
Nice.
And
it's
a lot
fun
of fun.
Show.
The musicians are on stage. They're personal testimonials and a lot of laughter.
Mm-hmm.
This is the second time for that, but it hadn't been back for about 7 or 8 years.
Okay.
So that's Smoke on the Mountain. Then we follow that with Father of the Bride.
Fun comedy.
A lot of fun. Plus something people have related to for a long, long time. You go back to the Spencer Tracy movie and lately the Steve Martin movie. That side of life hasn't changed that much.
And then you guys are tackling Les Mis in the fall, in October,
huh? Can hardly wait. We have an amazing cast put together. Eddie and Ron Morgan, who is our choreographer, came back from New York. Was just some terrific people. And the mixture of the New York actors mm-hmm. plus our local actors plus the actors that have worked for us before, it's a nice family feel. And that's one of the things we go for. We like to think of Beef and Boards as a family. It's a family operation.
Sure.
But we like to treat people as family, so they want to come back.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things they always come back for, the Beef and Boards Christmas, I always enjoy that. That's it's a great show, great holiday tradition.
It is, and we have a new one lined up this year, so
very good.
It should be fun.
So what are you doing specifically to celebrate this 40th anniversary? I mean, are you guys having a big party, a reunion?
No, well, we had a nice little press party mm-hmm. for the opening of one of the shows,
yeah.
but it's just letting everybody know, hey, we've been around, we're planning on being around, because we all enjoy what we're doing.
I mean, it really is commendable to keep any theater going 40 years mm-hmm. and maintaining that high level of quality. And congratulations on that.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Really appreciate it.
Well, happy anniversary to Beef and Boards. And,
thank you.
Looking forward to seeing you out there.
And I'll sing my anniversary song on the way out.
Very good.
Travis DiNicola with Beef and Boards Dinner Theater owner Doug Stark. The Sound of Music is currently being performed at the Dinner Theater, and you can find out more about Beef and Boards at beefandboards.com. And is spelled out, don't use the ampersand, beefandboards.com. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
Do you hear what I hear?
What is that?
Woo!
Oh, it's that sound from the Speedway. That's right. It is race weekend.
It is.
It is. And of course, there's that parade and there's that race and all those other things.
Which is not to say those things aren't artistic, but there are other things going on.
This weekend in Indianapolis.
That we'll tell you about on
What'll We Do? Okay, this is actually next week. It's not actually this weekend. It is next week, and it's not even an arts event, but Sharon, I had to put this on. Are you ready?
I'm sitting down. I'm ready.
The Humane Society is at capacity with cats right now, and so they are offering a cat adoption special next week. Okay, and it's going to be Monday through Sunday, the 20th through the 26th, $19.99 for selected cats for the adoption fee. Normally, it's $75, and they just have so many cats, and because it is that season where they've got an influx of cats, because, you know, there's a lot of cats out there because they've been...
Kitten season.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. So there are over 30 cats that are on special at $19.99. If you've been thinking about getting one, go help the Humane Society out and take home a cute little kitten.
Oh, actually, better yet, take two, so they're
friends.
But do it responsibly. Don't do it on whim just because Travis and I said so. Actually, I'm proud of us. Everybody who listens regularly knows what cat lovers we are. But between the two of us, we only have six cats.
Indoor cats. Yeah.
We won't talk about the feral ones we feed. Okay. Well, you know, cats can help. Actually, there was a study by a major human resources firm about 15 years ago that suggests that having pets in the workplace, if you're in a creative field, can help you be even more creative. So there's the artistic component of the Humane Society's cat adoption
special. We won't talk about what my cat Agatha just did on my desk the other day at home. Anyway, your turn, Sharon.
It helped you be creative and cleaning up. The weather has told you this recently. It's almost summer, and the Summer Nights film series is back. You know what? This has been going on since the 1970s at the IMA, and it's every Friday night this summer in the IMA Amphitheater on the west side of the museum facing the Virginia B. Fairbanks Art and Nature Park, the one popularly known as 100 Acres. Gather friends and family. It's an evening under the stars, and enjoy the season's featured films ranging from timeless black and white favorites to modern cult classics. And the series kicks off June 7th with Pillow Talk, a 1959 classic directed by Michael Gordon. Very squeaky clean romantic comedy, Pillow Talk.
Squeaky clean. Hey, this is a neat way to celebrate some Indiana history along with some great music at the Propylaeum at their Carriage House, actually, at 1410 North Delaware. They are doing a piano bar. Piano bar returning to Talbot Street, because apparently back in the 1930s, Talbot Street was home to 7 piano bars and was considered Piano Alley. And so this tradition has been revived by the Propylaeum. They're going to have a whole bunch of different emerging artists tickling the ivories and serenading you with voices from the past. And they've also got... dinner and a la carte menu and bar and all that sort of stuff. Great music from the 30s and 40s, also with special art exhibits gracing the walls of the Carriage House. And this sounds really cool. It's taking place both June 8th and June 9th, 7 p.m. both nights. Reservations are required, and you can get more information at thepropylaeum.org. That's spelled the, and that's P-R-O, you know how to spell that. Propylaeum, P-R-O-P-Y-L-A-E-U-M, propylaeum.org, or give them a call, 638-7881. That sounds really cool.
7 piano bars back in the day. I want to learn more about that. I know, right? Some things are worth bringing back. Hey, the Indiana Wind Symphony has its final concert of the season May 20. 5th. That is really soon, so make plans now. It's at 7:30 at the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts. Music of Gustav Holst. Carl King, who was one of America's great march writers, right up there with John Philip Sousa. And as they say, much, much more. If you've never heard the Indiana Wind Symphony, you owe it to yourself. Great music in an acoustically wonderful place for a wind band. So that's coming up again May 25th. That's this Saturday at 7:30 p.m. at the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts.
That sounds like a win-win for everyone.
Love it.
Hey, Saturday, June 1st, it's the Wicked World of Croquet at the President Benjamin Harrison Home. And Sharon, it is actually sold out for the competitive brackets throughout the day for the competition.
That's fantastic.
Which is really cool. But in the evening, starting at 5 o'clock, from 5 to 8:30, there is the croquet mixer. And this is for more casual fans of croquet. And you can come and play and learn and play with your friends, play with other people, and eat and snack and socialize. And, of course, wearing white is required, or at least encouraged. And ticket includes lessons and equipment and food and beverage. You can get more information at the President Benjamin Harrison Home's website. At bhpsite.org.
Fantastic.
There we go.
That sound you heard was
a croquet roquet
hitting ball. Yes. You know,
nicely
it's
done.
Public radio. We could
great
buy sound effects.
No,
CDs,
no, no. I like
but...
what you're doing. You're making your own so well.
Hey, lots.
I hear someone at the door. What? We're coming to get you, Sharon.
Is that a straight jacket? Yeah. Oh, dear. Lots of great music going on June 7th and 8th at June 7th at 8 and June 8th at 5:30. There'll be a quiz. Are you paying attention? Mm-hmm. So June 7th, Friday night at 8, Saturday evening at 5:30. Christoph Urbanski is on the podium. And wonderful pianist Jean-Yves Thibaudet plays the Macmillan Third Piano Concerto, a fairly challenging contemporary work. It's subtitled The Mysteries of Light. Also on the program, Ludoslavsky's Concerto for Orchestra and the Overture to the Abduction from the Seraglio by Mozart. So nice variety of music on June 7th and June 8th. More information at Indianapolis Symphony. org.
Speaking of music, Kathy Morris, the jazz violinist, is back in town for a little bit. In fact, she's playing on the 23rd at the History Center as part of their Canal Series and playing the Victory Dinner for the 500 Victory Dinner on the 27th. But you can catch her at Garfield Park as part of their concert series coming up on June 6th from 6 to 8 p.m. And then a little bit later in June on the 15th as part of the Taste of Tippecanoe, she'll be playing out there as well.
You know, the Indianapolis Children's Choir has been around nearly three decades, and so there's lots of Children's Choir alums scattered throughout the world. They also have a long tradition of summer camp, running a summer camp that teaches young singers in just 5 days all sorts of great skills. And at the end of the camp, they have a big choral festival concert, which combines the talents of a number of choirs and includes the choral festival campers as well as the several choirs affiliated with the Indianapolis Children's Choir. It's on Saturday, June 15th at 3 p.m. at Clues Hall at Butler University. So you can go and hear lots of gorgeous, gorgeous young voices.
Very cool. Hey, and Final Fridays coming up at the IMA. That would be next Friday, May 31st, 6 p.m. It is free for IMA members, and this one's going to be kind of cool. They're going to have in the DeBose Lecture Hall behind-the-scenes talk where they're going to be talking about how they curated the Ai Weiwei exhibit according to what? Ai Weiwei according to what? And this is a very cool thing. You do want to RSVP if you can for this. It is for members, and then, of course, afterwards, there's the Final Friday party that they have that is always a lot of fun as well. But you can learn how that crew moved a 10-ton work of art from one location to another. How cool is that?
Very cool. While you're at the IMA, if your taste leans to something a little older, a little more traditional, check out the William Hogarth exhibit. It's called The Painter of Comic History. He is a basically 18th century, born in 1697, lived to 1764, so a long life. Born in London and lived most of his life there, but he did in painting what a lot of literary contemporaries did in their works, a lot of satire. So The Painter of Comic History. Lots of paintings showing human foibles.
Interesting.
At the IMA.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. Well, Sharon, that is all the time we have. So enjoy your Memorial Day.
I don't know how to make the sound of fried chicken.
That was pretty
I'm
good.
Sorry.
And we'll be back next week with more of
What Do We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
On the brink of adolescence, Reeby Bryson starts to believe he might be the second coming of Christ. But when his adoring mother suddenly disappears, Reeby is challenged to test his powers. Brian Furunis is the author of the new novel, The Lost Episodes of Reeby Bryson. He teaches writing at Butler University, and Sharon Gamble invited him to our studio to talk about the book. He began by reading the novel's beginning.
The year I turned 12, I believed I was the second coming of Christ. I have a good guess about how I came up with this idea, but it's harder to say what sustained the belief beyond an initial what if. Nothing about me suggested divinity. Apart from my overdeveloped imagination, I was a pretty normal kid, skinny, buzz cut, prone to daydreams, but still a B student because my teachers preferred my occasional catatonia to the spastic violence displayed by my classmates. The fact that I had lived for 11 years without so much as a hint of holiness did not dissuade me. After all, the first Jesus didn't find out his true identity until he was 12. According to my mother, anyway, who made up Bible stories. Actually, she claimed that her stories were chapters of the original Bible that hadn't made the final cut, but even I could tell that she'd made them up. Her lost episodes were mostly about the boyhood of Jesus, but they featured cars, steel mills, and transistor radios, among other artifacts not generally associated with life at the outset of Anno Domini. Her Jesus watched Cheers while half-heartedly strumming his electric guitar. I might not have grown up in the church, but even I knew that Christ did not come of age in the mid-80s in Paris, Indiana. Still, her lost episodes were not easily dismissed. My mother's imagination was a swirling galaxy, and her stories were spirits moving over the face of the deep, calling forms out of the void. Wild as prophecy and seemingly just as coded, her stories told a truth deeper than reality. She never actually told me I was the second coming, not in so many words, but nevertheless, this was the message I took from her stories. Her Jesus felt as real and recognizable as a lost twin. It never occurred to me that she might have modeled Jesus on me. I was certain I'd been modeled on him.
So I have to ask at the beginning, how do you find the world of your narrator? How do you get inside the mind of this kid?
Mm-hmm. The first thing that came to me was the mother's voice. And the very first kernel of this novel was the mother's voice telling a made-up Bible story. And so I had to figure out first, you know, who is this woman who's telling the story? Why is she doing it? And then I got really interested in the question of audience. Who is she telling this to? And how would somebody respond to a story like this?
How did you first hear her voice? I know that bits and pieces of this novel found their way into other writing, mm-hmm. earlier writing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had I'd been reading a lot of a writer named Lewis Norden, and one of my favorite stories of his is called The Sears and Roebuck Catalog Game.
Love it.
It's about a mother who makes up stories with her son, and they do it by looking at the Sears and Roebuck catalog and making up stories about the people in the photos and the lives that they might lead. And I loved that story so much, and I read it and read it and read it. And then one day when I was driving on 465, I could still see it. I was coming up on my 56th Street exit, and this mother's voice came to me like a gift. I could hear her telling a made-up Bible story. So I whipped the car off the road and wrote down the first five or six lines of that Bible story on the back of a receipt.
I love it. So there is a lot of craft in writing. There's also pure inspiration. Do you have a technique by which you try to force the muse to come to you?
Yeah, I put my butt in a seat for about 2.5-3 hours 6 days a week. I love inspiration when it comes, but it doesn't come very often. I believe a lot more in the power of work and the power of persistence. I completely welcome those moments that come, you know, usually right at the beginning of a project and then again at the end to allow you to finish. This whole book didn't come as easily as that first made-up Bible story.
You weren't Mozart transcribing the voice of God through your hand into a laptop.
I wish. No. My process was a lot more workmanlike than that.
As are most artists, mm-hmm. if you scratch the surface, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
I suspect you do something to disabuse your own writing students of that image that you... I read you describe this image of yourself gazing out from essentially the ivory tower in a silk shirt. And what were you? You were smoking thin cigarettes and drinking grappa, waiting for the next inspiration.
Right. Yeah, that was my old kind of romantic vision of what it would be like to be a writer. And that survived right up until I, you know, actually started writing and realized that it's not that way at all. A lot of my students have... So I teach at Butler University. I teach mainly first-year students, mm-hmm. And a lot of them have a similar idea about writing and about writers. And many of them think that, you know, either you have it or you don't. Either you're a really talented writer who can just bang out beautiful stuff in one draft, or you don't have it. And I talk about process a lot, and I show them my own process, help them find their own way. And along the way, we all discover that we have to work a lot harder than we initially thought.
You might also bring in, at some point, I picture you bringing in the catalogs for all those MFA in writing degrees, or why would they exist if it weren't a lot of hard work, right, if you couldn't develop your craft?
Yeah, if it was just inspiration... then, you know, I would have no business teaching writing because then it would be a sham. If it was either you have it or you don't, then there shouldn't be any writing programs at all. The fact that I teach writing and that a lot of other people teach writing speaks to our belief that writing is a craft. It is something that can be developed and learned.
Now, you've created a very explicit world in the region mm-hmm. up near Chicago. How did you research that world, or do you have some personal experience with that world?
That's where I grew up.
Aha. Uh-huh.
I grew up in the area that called itself Chicagoland, mm-hmm. Desperately trying to associate itself with Chicago.
We're over the line, but trust us, we bleed Chicago.
That's right. It's kind of a Lake County and Porter County up there are kind of demilitarized zones. They're technically in Indiana, but not really of Indiana. But Illinois doesn't really want them either. Mm-hmm. So they refer to themselves as Chicagoland. Mm-hmm. And that's where I grew up. The town of Paris, Indiana, in my book, is kind of an amalgam of all the little towns around Gary.
So the Hobarts of the world.
Yeah. Hobart, Merrillville, Schererville, mm-hmm. Dyer, all those little towns.
With their attendant sense of in the era of the book, bad economy, the big mills are shutting, the little mm-hmm. mills, the recycling mills are starting. Mm-hmm. Tell me about how your relationship to the novel changed. You worked on it for about as long as your narrator is old.
Yeah, I ended up working on it for nearly 10 years.
Yeah. Is that a long process of little tweaks of saying, I don't like this paragraph, I need to do something different here, or bigger plot revisions, or all of the above, or something else?
There was a lot of big movement. My editing tools were mainly earth-moving equipment for the first 8 years. It's a lot of changes. I initially drafted this as a series of stories and then started over with the same characters and many of the same situations, redrafted it as a novel, and then burned that entire thing down and started over because it had a fundamental flaw in it that couldn't be band-aided.
Hmm.
I ended up doing about 16 drafts. And many of those drafts are substantially different.
You had a partner at your publishing house, a partner in crime, and who helped you restructure your novel. What mm-hmm. was that process like?
I had a lot of help. That's the other. You were talking earlier about writerly myths and artistic myths. The other myth is that, you know, the artist operates alone. Hmm. The writer creates these things in his mountaintop cabin and then comes down from the mount to deliver them to the people. And that's absolutely not true, especially in my case. I had a lot of help from the teachers in my grad program to my agent, who may be the best editor that I've ever worked with, and then finally the editor at the publishing house. My agent helped me take this from a manuscript that was about 470 pages when she got it down to, I think it's about 260 right now. And she helped me figure out, you know, what was really important, what's the heart of this book, and once I figured out that, I knew what could be pared away to showcase that heart.
Revy struggles with faith in that, and I'm being cautious here because I don't want to give too much away for people who are going to read this, but at some point he feels that the power he has is the power to hold his family together.
That's right.
How did you figure out how to not break his heart completely in the story?
Mm-hmm. I think I did my best to destroy him. And I had to, given the structure of this novel. So in the beginning, as you probably realized from the passages that I read, the kid thinks that he's the second coming of Jesus. And there's a point, you know, certain things happen, there's an accident, and he realizes through those events that he's not the second coming of Christ. But the rest of the novel kind of carries forward that the underlying theme of death and resurrection. So I had to really destroy Revy through the events of this book, so that he and his family could be resurrected in the end. He survives, you know, he comes through as a different person in the end, not only alive, but stronger in many ways. But he had to go through those terrible circumstances to become that stronger person.
And along the way, he has a pretty serious flirtation with science, this man, young man of faith, this boy of faith.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that comes from all my obsessions are in this book.
Cool.
Yeah.
Wait, does that mean you've poured them out and you don't have them anymore?
No, I don't think I can ever exhaust them. This book has God and death and kind of madcap science, and you know, this idea of reinvention or resurrection. These are all things that I find myself coming back to again and again and again in all my work.
You play out your own relationship with spirituality in some other places too. You're involved in a project called On Earth as It Is.
Mm-hmm.
Would you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, a few years ago, I was doing a lot of thinking about prayer and also about dramatic monologues. And it occurred to me that a prayer is really just a dramatic monologue addressed to God. And, you know, what other dramatic monologue shows us at our most vulnerable, or perhaps our most manipulative, when we're trying to manipulate God into giving us what we want? And I thought, man, that would make a lot of really interesting stories. So along with a partner, I recruited several dozen writers to write these dramatic monologues or prayer narratives addressed to God. And we got a tremendous variety that are all showcased at onearthasitis.net now.
Sharon Gamble with writer and Butler University professor Brian Farunas. Find out more about his novel, The Lost Episodes of Reeve Bryson, at brianfarunas.com. And I will spell that for you. It's Brian with a Y, and then Farunas is spelled Faruness.com. Brianfarunas.com.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m. for some music and some dance. I'll start with bluegrass musician David Bagdad.
I want to see you dance on the radio, Travis. I'll chat with several local blues and jazz musicians about a new project they've done together.
And then I'll get a preview of the upcoming Modus dance performance. Plus, there'll be our calendar events we call
What Will We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.